Welcome to another episode of the Building Texas Show. We're going to sit down with our three-time guest, Miles Murray, from Locol today, and I'm excited to talk about the progress Locol's have over the last year since we last sat down, and a production unit. I mean, we've got boots on the ground. So I'm excited to hear Miles' story, the update on Locol, and really what to look forward to in 2026. So, Miles, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Justin, and thanks for having me back for, a third time, sort of the saga of a startup, you know, idea stage, then prototyping, and now we're here at commercial pilot. Couldn't be more excited.
Well, and I am too. I've enjoyed every phase of this, and our history together on this project goes back to really early days. But you have taken a product through that entire development cycle, and you have it on the ground in just outside of Houston, Texas. And that's the next phase of that production run and really seeing it come to fruition. So tell us again and remind everyone with Locol, what do you do?
Well, what we do is we strive to make landfills obsolete.
Right.
In the sense that when we look at the problem that we address is that this world continues to compile just massive amounts of underutilized resources that we end up calling trash. But a lot of times it's just people don't know what to do with it, or economically they can't find a better solution than to just truck it to a landfill and throw it away, which is a cost on time. It's a cost on money. It's a cost to society. And so we wanted to address that. And we felt that the, you know, waste reclamation space needed a new type of solution, one where the solution came to the source that the waste was produced, as opposed to trying to aggregate everything at a landfill and then do something with it once it's all mixed up and, you know, very difficult to work with. And so, you know, for those that don't know, Locol is a hardware technology company that's developed a new generation of waste to energy solution, where we not only take various types of waste, and what we focus on wood, and now we're working on tires, is to extract the energy without putting a lot of emissions into the atmosphere. And then we also sequester the carbon in a solid state. And then we upgrade that carbon and utilize it for a variety of industries. So what would normally be a cost to somebody, we've turned into a revenue stream.
And the founding story of this goes back to your time in Iraq, your time in finding solutions in hard places. But now you're coming to the point where you have a beautiful system set up. You all have designed something that is mobile. Mobile is relative, right? It is able to meet the mission where it is.
Right.
And that's what I've always appreciated. You've also talked about reclaiming large acreage of lost industrial land. And to put it more clearly, places where they grow a lot of trees to turn them into pellets. But that can't really happen in the U.S. as easily as it has in the past from a regulation standpoint. So you see a vision of being able to go in and solve those distressed assets or assets that are sitting there in maybe 5-10,000 acre tree farms and turning them into a useful part of the economy again. Do I understand that right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a bit multifaceted, but I'll try to be a straight shooter in this. The idea of growing trees, cutting them down and turning them into pellets and sending them overseas is becoming less and less economically viable. And it's a bit kind of ridiculous that that's how far we have to take it, all the way to Japan or all the way to Europe. And so, you know, the idea that we are constantly trying to find ways to produce power while also fighting against the, you know, the economic or the environmental factors, if you will. Regulations often have to do with what is the pain to the public good in order to produce a public good. So this balance between, you know, right now we're projecting a 40% deficit in energy demand currently on our production schedule. So there is an absolute worldwide race to find any way to turn an atom into electron. And so where we're sort of intersecting is that we've got an economy that needs more localized energy, energy sources that we grow domestically, and the desire to do so in a way that isn't destructive. And so there's some competing forces here. But I think that we're right at the intersection of a solution that at least meets one very specific logistics problem. And that is, if you can turn it into clean energy and other commodities, upgraded commodities, then there's no point of throwing it away because it's no longer trash. It's a valuable feedstock.
And that could be something as simple as pallets.
Correct. Pallets. You can see the pallet wall that I have behind me. It's actually customer number one for our use case. We've landed our first pilot at 4840 pallets or 4840 solutions. And they're the largest pallet recycler in the country. Wonderful team. Really been a great partner so far. They're producing, you know, a fair amount of tailings in their process of manufacturing and recycling these pallets, where they take an old pallet. Well, let's just say they take five old pallets, and with those five old pallets, they're able to make four, you know, sort of restored pallets for resale. But there's enough material that's in broken boards and clippings that it ends up in a pile of waste. And until we've, you know, started working together, and for however many years, they've been trying to find ways to get rid of that pile, whether they have to throw it away or they give it to a mulching company. But it's always a logistical headache that requires transportation and cost.
We've talked about mulch too, now that you bring it up, and I'm always amazed when the mulch fires break out, which wasn't a thing I really understood until it happened locally. And I see the danger of wood waste or any kind of waste sitting there in a pile like that. I don't know that people understand, and maybe in a 30-second version, how does a pile of wood catch on fire by itself?
Pressure and heat ultimately create, you know, the scenario for combustion. And so, you know, what people don't realize is that when you're driving down the interstate, you don't really see a lot of piles of anything. But if you go 2 miles to the right or left, you'll start seeing all these piles. Mulch is interesting because it's about a 95% saturated market. That means that for every 100 tons of mulch that could be created, only 5 tons of it are commercializable. So most of your mulch ends up in large piles and sits there for a long time. And, you know, in certain areas where you have seasonality, where it gets really, really dry, these become fire hazards that, you know, the U.S. Forestry Service has recognized that, you know, forest slash and undergrowth and not just mulch, but just, you know, where all this, you know, this timber slashings, you know, sort of pile up, they can be accelerants to very large wildfires that we've seen in the last decade.
Yeah, wildfires make me nervous in Texas. I don't think that, we've experienced them in some terrible ways across the state, but here locally in the Hill Country, I think that's one that's top of my mind as something we should be thinking about. And I've always appreciated that you've looked at it from a way of, how do we get the piles out of here so that they don't increase that risk?
You know, we've had a natural disaster in our area since the last time we talked, and you and I both were in, you know, pretty well good constant communication during that time. You know, as an environmental engineer, I look at what are we doing with the, you know, the natural habitats, and then how the human interface with the natural world. With the floods that hit us over summer, you know, it goes to show that, you know, we had an incredible amount of debris that is still piled up. It is still trying to be managed. And now that we've hit, you know, 6 months from now, or 6 months at this point, and we're still managing through all this. What people don't realize is that when these types of disasters happen, the regrowth also is rapid, but it's, you know, these are junior, these are small junior plants that then, you know, grow rapidly and then they dry out whenever the normal Texas seasonality returns. Texas is 88% more likely to have, or Central Texas, especially Kendall County, where we live in the Central Hill Country area, we're 88% more likely to have a wildfire than the average around the country. And, you know, you really look at, like, the West Coast is where everyone sort of always the news is about, and there's lots of wildfires, and it's very destructive out there. But here in Texas, we do have a pretty significant risk ourselves, and we don't necessarily have a private sector sort of economical solution for mitigating this. We have great response capabilities, but to get in front of it, you need an economy that attracts debris in a way that we can, you know, turn it into energy and other commodities.
Yeah, I think of the cedar growth that we have here, the cedar piles that we see around, that all could be turned into charcoal. And that biochar that you create, how is that being used? And so we've talked a little bit about the machine. It takes the wood waste in, it incinerates it at a really high temperature, and incinerate might not be the right word, but
right,
it takes it at a very high temperature and converts it to energy and biochar. And people are starting to use biochar commercially in their tomato gardens.
Right.
Right.
There's been a lot of uses. You know, I would say when I started this journey back in 2018, very few people had heard of biochar. And yep, it's amazing. 2026 is coming up, and we've been at it for 8 years pretty aggressively. And in these 8 years, there's been an incredible amount of research and development that's been done on the uses of biochar in order to create that outlet, so that not only are you producing energy, but what underpins the economics as well is this biochar. We've learned that certain purity levels are needed for certain industries. You know, the higher the purity, the more valuable the carbon becomes, because it ends up becoming closer and closer to mined carbon deposits. And the closer we get to that, and it's not one for one, you know, the scientific community has a lot of opinions about biocarbon versus other forms and what their structures and uses and capabilities are. But there's a constant evolving body of science that's finding ways, not only in the agricultural space, which helps restore carbon deposits inside the soil, which allows for more microbial life to grow, which creates a more richer and healthier and durable soil. And we grow a lot of food. We grow a lot of food commercially in the United States. And so our use of fertilizers and flushing, you know, water through the substrate is becoming more and more taxing. Not only is it less attractive to eat food that was grown this way, but it's also really becoming difficult to grow in certain regions. That purity level, as it moves up market, moves into things like concrete, asphalt blending, and moving even further into, you know, utilization of green steel, where the carbon that's utilized or a portion thereof is how steel is made. Filtration devices, and then you even go further where the science is still sort of on the cutting edge, which is battery development and, you know, uses of graphite and graphene.
Hey, we've talked about a number of different use cases here in the last few minutes. We've talked about what you're doing and why you do it. What's the state of LoCol today? Where are you? What's the next phase? And what are we excited about in 2026?
Well, like you said at the beginning of the call, we've sort of taken a pretty systematic approach to hitting funding milestones with production milestones. And, you know, as one of our first believers, Justin, with the Angel Network, you know, we started with a concept that said, could we build a box that had enough capability inside of it to create industry disruptive action, meaning that those who have never considered their feedstock to be a fuel source or a carbon source are now entering into the market. those that have before are starting to look at our generation of technology and seeing, okay, well, that solves more than one problem. It does a lot. So where we're at, well, we've built the commercial grade size system. We've installed it at 4840. We've also built a unique native software that's full stack inside the system so that it can not only be fully automated, but collect the needed reports that allow for industries such as the energy sector, the carbon markets, the regulatory marketplace for the data that's needed. As a result, we've achieved over $250 million in letters of intent with a commitment of $50 million through a strategic partner in Curtis Stout Power to start building these facilities all around the United States. We've also patented the technology, which our patent is issued in September. So we have got a lot of runway through 2044 to protect our intellectual property and our product. And so we've also patented it in Australia, European Union, and the United Kingdom. These are all areas that are really looking for this turnkey power plant carbon sequestration system that easy to operate, effective in its mission, and also can be located wherever you need it to be. So take it to where the problem exists and don't create more problems in the process of solving it.
Yeah, when you talk about building them across the U.S., I want people to realize this isn't building a new shopping mall or a new development. This is a very small footprint, big solution piece.
Right. So I think maybe some people are still trying to visualize this.
Right.
I think what people need to visualize is that this is a bioenergy plant. There is a pile of waste. There is a grinder that grinds it down to a very specific size. It feeds into our bioenergy system that uses a combination of four different types of technology. One of them is thermal decomposition, which is also known as pyrolysis. And for the common person, that would be an oven that moves like in a conveyance, but without oxygen, so that it doesn't turn everything into ash. Then all the gas that is normally a dirty biogas that's full of, sulfuric acid moves through a filtration process where we clean it to the best of our ability, and it gets so clean that it's below EPA standards and it can operate a generator that's configured for this type of gas. And what also comes out is a bunch of oil that you consider as, bio oil. And that is then stored inside tanks that can be shipped off to different companies that like to blend these chemicals with other products. And so you end up with what was a pile of waste that needed to be handled and transported and thrown away. And it was a cost and it was a regulatory, sort of difficult process to follow, has now been completely turned into either energy, carbon, or a form of fuel and fertilizer. With very little, less than 1% ash in the process. So a zero waste recycling center for organic materials, and now we're stepping into rubber as well.
And it's the size of a semi-truck trailer.
It's a 50-foot system that is basically your maximum flatbed-sized module that can be transported. So it can be transported by rail, by truck, or by ship. Standard lift and drop type of modularity with all of our ancillary equipment as well. So that, you could show up with 8 flatbed trucks, and within a couple of weeks, you've got yourself a power plant that can move, about 50 tons of material per system per day.
So if you're a county judge somewhere in Texas that wants to be innovative and get rid of your mulch, get rid of your tires, get rid of really that conversation about the combustible wood pile over here, this is a product that you should be thinking about, talking about, getting to know.
So well, I also it's interesting that you bring up, municipalities and where can public leaders engage in this. We developed this technology under the U.S. Air Force Small Business and Innovation Research Program. And we've been through phase one, phase two, the extended phase two for technologies of our size and scope. And now that we've installed at 4840, once we're finished with the commissioning process, we'll be considered a phase three, where you can directly procure our technology as a federal entity. And I have not been able to ascertain whether or not you seek federal funds first, but at the municipal level, working with the Air Force, Department of Energy, U.S. Forestry Service, there's an opportunity to take, you know, at least a portion thereof of public funding to develop these systems. And why would public funding be needed? Well, let's think about what we're producing. We're producing electricity. That is a public good. We are sequestering waste from landfills that ultimately end up in soil and water streams. That is a public good. We have developed the needed data taxonomy to track from at the effectively the molecular level from where the waste started and where it ended up. So that, you know, when you hear about things like carbon credits and people are like, that's a bunch of hocus pocus. It is whenever you're measuring it from a helicopter over the Amazon. It is not whenever you're weighing your purity of carbon and your weight of carbon together and you know exactly how much you've sequestered from the atmosphere. And then what do we do with it? Well, we restore soil. We improve the strength of concrete. We improve the ability to produce steel domestically. All of these are what is part of the, you know, the public good, if you will. And it's done in a capitalistic way.
Ag extension agents should be talking about how can I get your biochar for my farm fields. Right. It's such a great opportunity. And I've been engaged in the process and just in awe of the process as you've taken this from 55-gallon drums to a 50-foot container now that really has seen this come to fruition. You can talk about these things at the molecular, electron, atom level, but I think for the common listener, it is that power of taking wood waste, tires, those big piles that you can see in your mind, and converting them into economic good, a cleaner environment, and an economic impact for our agriculture, whether that's moving the piles to avoid fire or that's using the biochar in the fields. I see that full circle goodwill from the company, and it's been really incredible to see you go through all of these phases. Yeah. As we wrap up today, what do we look for in 2026? Where can people come to learn more?
Well, you know, our website is www.locoal.com, where we post somewhat, you know, regular updates. And you can also follow us on LinkedIn. That's our primary social media. You know, 2026 is the breakout year. This is when we move from a commercial pilot and late stage research and development company, and we punch into market with our first commercial offering where we're not our own financier and operator, where we are developed now buyers and operators of our technology who then want to create that circular economy in their local region. And so look for some pretty big announcements with partnerships of brands that everyone utilizes every day across the world. Also look for, you know, opportunities in your local community where you believe that, you know, this could be an impact for me. And you can contact me at miles@locoal.com. And again, our website is www.locoal.com.
Well, Miles, it's been a pleasure to visit with you again. I'm excited for you and the team and everything you've been able to continue to accomplish. And 2026 is going to be that breakout year. So I'm excited if you're an investor, if you're a potential customer, if you're someone that just wants to learn more, don't miss the opportunity to watch Locoal, get involved with Locoal, and see them make a big impact across the country. I'm really proud of what they've done. So, Miles, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.